is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
The Vancouver Art Gallery recently opened an exhibition of works by local artist Brian Youngen. Born in St. John, Youngen graduated from Emily Carr in 1992 and has since garnered a reputation around the world with successful shows in New York and Edinburgh. He has recently been awarded the prestigious Sobey Award for Emerging Canadian Artists, and Josh Brandon went to the show this week and he joins me now in the studio. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
What was in the exhibition?
Well, it was a pretty comprehensive survey of his works. Took up the whole second floor of the art gallery, and some of the pieces were quite large pieces. The highlight of the show was there was a collection of masks, and that you've probably seen some of the ads on bus stops. There were these masks made out of Nike runners. And it was apparently the first time that all 23 masks were collected in one place. And the title of those pieces was called Prototypes for a New Understanding. And a lot of his work, like those masks, have a kind of First Nations theme. It builds on his own background, coming from Fort St. John as half Dunéza. Native background and part Swiss, apparently. So it was a really large exhibition. There's these giant whale skeletons floating in the air, and a lot of installations. Some of them were more sculptural than others, but it was interesting.
What was your impression of the exhibition?
Well, like I said, the pieces were really massive, a lot of them. The whale skeletons were really life size, and you just felt you were confronted with this whale hanging over your head as you come up the stairs. And so that was really striking. There was a lot of diversity of the works, ranging from some sculptures to installations. There was one section of the gallery that was boarded off with plywood and a caged fence, and inside they had an aviary with finch flying around. So it's not the usual thing you see in an art gallery.
Was there a particular piece that stood out for you?
There was one that really did strike me in a particular way. It was called Isolated Depiction of the Passage of Time. And actually, when I first saw it, I almost passed over it. It was just on a wooden pallet. There was stacked in a cube about 1,500... cafeteria trays, like you would see at any cafeteria or at a lot of fast food restaurants, and they were in different colors, and you didn't really notice it until you stood close to it for a minute and you heard that there was faint sounds, voices being emitted from inside. And it struck me enough that I went to go read a little bit more about it. They had a bit of a description on it on the wall, and apparently this piece was inspired by a work that's in the museum at Kingston Penitentiary, where one of the prisoners had fashioned out of the food trays an escape pod, and he'd glued together thousands of these food trays and had hollowed out an inside portion of them to try to escape from when they carted away the food trays. And so he's transformed this into an art piece. And I thought that was really an interesting idea. And then inside he has a television set playing The Great Escape, the movie. So it was an interesting idea, that piece.
Very clever. Do we know whether the prisoner successfully escaped?
I don't believe he did, unfortunately.
maybe a more aesthetic idea than a successful escape pod.
Right.
Now, one of Jungen's most publicized work is a series of masks made from Nike runners, which you mentioned earlier. What do you think is the significance of his use of Nike products?
Well, Nike really is one of the corporations that's most associated with globalization. There's been, you know, a lot of accusation of their use of sweatshops. And also, they really are a symbol of consumer excess. You know, people spending $150 for a pair of runners that cost the company 15 cents to make in Indonesia or some other country. And so it's really, I think it's become one of the most striking icons and the antagonist of the anti-corporate branding movement, like it's sort of associated with Naomi Klein and her no logo. And the pieces apparently were started in 1998. They were completed over a 7-year period. But I think it's a significant date in that that was shortly after the APEC protests here in Vancouver, where there was a lot of awareness about Nike. So I think that date isn't insignificant. And I think he was also trying to, as well, create a bit of a linkage between Aboriginal culture and African American culture, because the Nike brand runners are it's very popular, I guess, among African American youth in the United States, and trying to draw those linkages, because the masks themselves are very much inspired by Native culture and. So drawing that linkage as well, I think.
A lot of Jungen's other work feature consumer goods. Is there a common theme that you drew from these pieces?
Well, I think he's really trying to reappropriate these branded goods as raw materials to create something else. And I think this really starts to pose the question of why art does have value. Because, you know, when you look at a branded good, you wonder, well, why are people paying $150 for that pair of runners? Or, that IKEA sofa that costs, you know, $50. Why does that brand give it value? And I think then you start to wonder, well, why does art have value? And why does some art have value and some other pieces of art don't have value? And what is then the value of Native culture? And because these masks that he creates, they're very very reminiscent of the Haida or Kwakawaka masks that are collected by museums around the world. And so this cultural appropriation is at the same time related to an instance of denigrating the local culture. And so I think he's playing with a lot of those different themes in his choice of materials.
Well, it's a complex cycle, because I guess corporate world is always trying to appropriate artwork, and then you always have to the process for the artist is then try to re-subvert that kind of appropriation and then appropriate the corporate work. So it's an ongoing kind of struggle to do that.
Right, and that's I think one of the strengths of his work is that he is able to recycle those materials in a productive way.
Now, just looking at the materials again, sometimes we have an idea of artists as working with specialized materials, with traditional art materials, yet Jungen uses a lot of everyday objects in his piece. Do you think he's actually addressing the line between arts and crafts?
I think so. I mean, one of his pieces explicitly was called the Arts and Craft Book Depository, and this was is another enormous piece. It's actually a house that was modeled after another house that was built in California around 1908 that was part of the Arts and Craft architectural movement at that time. And so the piece models itself on that. And inside the book depository, there's this collection of arts and crafts books. And it really starts to invite you to think about the place of art within the museum and the relationship there. And I think one of the messages that he's trying to get is the idea that, you know, there isn't really necessarily such a separation between arts and crafts. That separation is imposed by our dominant culture that sees, you know, what European men do as being art and what everybody else in the world does as being craft. So if you go to a lot of museums, you'll find, you know, on the bottom floor, there's a lot of objects that were appropriated from around the world by imperialists traveling here and there. And they bring home their First Nations masks and their other artifacts from around the world. And these are separated from, you know, the main pieces that are on the upper floors that are, you know, the European masters painted. And I think he's trying to make us think about some of the contradictions in that separation. I think the other thing that he's trying to do is make us think about the separation between industrial products and art. And so on the one hand, he uses these industrial products like shoes or plastic lawn chairs as materials. And then on the other hand, he recreates replicas of industrial materials like these beautiful cedar wooden pallets that were used in the piece I was talking about before, as well as in a couple of other pieces, that are, you know, made of the finest cedar, and they're most smoothly fashioned structures. And yet, you know, when you think of a cedar pallet, it's just this disposable object that's used, you know, in industry for carting objects around the world, right? And so I think he's drawing a lot of, trying to blur a lot of these boundaries that we have in our minds about art.
Do you think his pieces are successful in challenging stereotypes of Native culture?
I think a lot of them are quite good in that. There was one in particular that made me think was this. He has this cooler full of Pilsner beer, and you know, it's kind of taking the notion of, you know, when the first fur traders came here, bringing these offerings of alcohol to the First Nations people to try to corrupt them. And here he is trying to corrupt the art world by bringing beer into the art gallery. So I think he's doing a lot of really good plays like that. But I wonder sometimes whether some of the pieces are maybe a little too perfect and not open-ended enough. Because, you know, apparently, you know, Michael Jordan owns one of the masks, and, you know, these are they're so nice. They're something any, you know, wealthy person would want to invite into their home. You know, you have these beautiful artworks, and it's, I wonder whether or not people are able to be critical enough of them because they are so perfect.
Do you think it's clear who the intended audience is for the pieces?
Well, I don't know exactly who it was. The crowd there was quite small, some of the allusions to the pieces are a bit difficult to get. Like I said, you know, some of them I would almost walk by unless I'd read the description of them or did a bit more research. They are intriguing enough for me to at least want to go do that extra step. Some of the pieces, I wonder, though, whether they're a little out of place at an art gallery. One of the things I noticed was that piece that I mentioned, the Arts and Crafts Depository, it was intended, obviously, to be a more interactive piece. It was intended to invite you in, and apparently when it was first constructed, it was expected to almost act as a library. People would go there and study. In the art gallery, it's roped off, so you can't access that element to it. So I wonder whether or not the art gallery is the right place for it.
Well, I guess we'll give people the information that they need and the opportunity to go and have a look for themselves and assess whether that's the right place for them.
Yeah, well, I encourage people to go see it. I enjoyed it. It's showing at the Vancouver Art Gallery until April 30th. And don't make the same mistake that I did. Apparently, they've changed the donation day from Thursday to Tuesday. And so encourage you to go on the day when you can, when everyday people can afford to see these pieces.
Good tip. Thanks very much for coming in, Josh.
Thanks a lot.
Telling us about the show. I've been speaking with Josh Brandon, and Josh went to see the Brian Youngen exhibition at the Vancouver Art Gallery this week.
This is Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM. Audiences don't often get a chance to see films not only made by Vancouver filmmakers, but also set in Vancouver. Julia Kwan's film, Eve and Firehorse, has been receiving attention not only locally, but internationally. Laura Lamb saw the film, and she's here with her thoughts. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Good morning.
The publicity shows a little girl flying through the air, which must be Eve of the title. What's the Firehorse?
Well, as Eve, who is the little girl, explains in a voiceover at the beginning of the film, in Chinese astrology, every 64 years, the year of the horse is the year of the fire horse, and children born that year are believed to be overly willful, and apparently in the old days were often drowned because of the pain and suffering they would bring to a family. In that image that's used in the publicity, Eve is swimming in a kind of an imagination of being drowned.
Drowning is pretty drastic for willfulness. Is Eve a particularly willful child in the film?
Well, no. You know, in that then you have to think. It shows sometimes her Eve in her classroom, and you think, oh, every one of these kids was born in the year of the fire horse. Whoa, what a tough time it would be for the teacher if there was any truth to that. And actually, she's not really shown to be particularly willful. She's more extremely imaginative and perhaps perceptive beyond her years sometimes. As you might imagine, someone who's a stand-in for someone who becomes a film director, since this film is probably, or is partly autobiographical, there's only one minor act of rebellion shown in the film, and it's near the beginning of the film, and the guilt that Eve suffers from this is central to the theological quest which forms the bulk of the film.
And so with things like guilt and theology, it sounds like a fairly heavy film. Is that the case?
No, it isn't actually. The mood ranges from comic to touching. It's sort of a nostalgic memoir about growing up in a Chinese immigrant family in Vancouver in the 70s, although it probably could be anywhere in North America. The difficulties that Eve and her sister, who is a little bit older than her, is also a major character in the film, are not glossed over, but they're central to what goes on in the film, but they're treated rather lightly and with a kind of a fresh touch.
What are these difficulties in the film?
Well, racism is touched on. It's shown as being a factor, but in an interesting way, that it's not dealt with in a black and white manner, to turn a phrase, or a yellow and white manner. It's there, but it's sort of in the background. The central conflict is religious and cultural. And what happens is that Eve, led by her older sister, become Catholic. Her and her sister become Catholic converts. And trying to resolve those beliefs with the traditional Chinese practices that they have at home creates most of the comedy and is sort of central to the family conflict, the social conflict, the interpersonal conflict that goes on outside of the family, and even her inner psychological conflict. So I was I was quite struck by the theology in this film.
Are the parents opposed to the conversion to Catholicism?
Well, not really. The mother, when she hears about her daughter's interest in becoming Christian, says, this is an exact quote, but something like, two gods are better than one. The more the merrier sort of thing. And she buys a crucifix, or several crucifixes, and sticks them up on their altar where they have the Buddha and the goddesses, ornaments, and where they give offerings to the ancestors. And she also says, both Buddha and Jesus teach us how to be good, so they don't conflict. But actually, the conflict happens between the two belief systems, between two opposing understandings of the world that the girls are then confronted with.
And how does the film treat the opposing theologies?
Well, the family religion is nominally Buddhist, but it's not the type of Buddhism that I, or probably most Westerners who've been curious about Buddhism, know about. It's not, meditation and Eastern philosophy, the Four Noble Truths, or the all this suffering monks. It's really a set of rituals and respect for the ancestors. Rituals which show respect for the ancestors, but predominantly it's about luck and how a person's behavior can affect luck. So, for instance, chopping a tree has a magical effect on your luck because you've broken a life cycle. It can break the life cycle in your family. Cooking noodles, which are very long, will affect positively your longevity, but if somebody chokes on those noodles, that's a curse on the whole family. Luck is also shown to be finite in their worldview. So if you have a remarkable lucky event, you might have to leave where you're living because your luck in that place is all used up. In this kind of worldview, if something bad happens, for instance, a death in the family, it may be your fault because of something you did to upset the luck. And this very much plays into the children's common belief that's well understood, that children feel that bad things are their fault. In this system of belief, there's nothing you can do about it. It's done, it's your fault, and that's luck.
So we've talked about the Buddhism, the traditional belief system of the family. What about the Catholicism? What attracts the girls to it?
Well, as a Westerner, I guess I'm on more familiar ground here with the Catholicism, but I think the Catholicism gives the girls something to do about it, about their feelings of grief and guilt. They're first introduced to Christianity through Jehovah's Witnesses coming to the door and giving them a book that shows these beautiful, kitschy pictures of heaven and so on. As the book says, if we all believe in Jesus, there would be no war and disease, and all the bad people will fall off the earth. So it offers solutions. And when the girls go to the Catholic Sunday school, the first thing Eve says is, I want to know about heaven. Obviously another solution, and then of course Catholicism offers them all kinds of things they can do, for instance penance, and they take that up with a vengeance, and they form their own little Catholic club called the Girls of Perpetual Sorrow, of which the two sisters are the only members, and undertake their own personal plan of penance. And also when another crisis comes up in the family, they get the idea that by evangelizing and making converts to Catholicism, they can change things for the better in their own lives. And all these things are treated, very comically. There's lots of room for humor in that.
And is there any conflict when the two worldviews collide?
Well, the mother at first thinks the idea of the girls becoming Christians is probably going to be good because she hopes it, she knows that there's a commandment that honor your father and your mother, and she thinks that that will reinforce the values of honoring parents, which she sees as being something that's threatened in Western society, something that the family worries about. So she's hopeful about that, but instead, of course, it turns out that the Catholic doctrine is that it's a sin to worship other gods. So creates a conflict with the girls and actually creates disrespectful acts towards the parents' traditional observances. So that's the most obvious conflict. But then there's other conflicts which are more deeply inside the girls. For one thing, their beloved grandmother cannot be in heaven because she didn't believe in Jesus. They get this information from a stereotypically saccharine / severe nun who's their Sunday school teacher, who is played to a T to that stereotype that we're all familiar with. Another kind of classic moment of doubt happens when the family goes to see the film The Ten Commandments in Chinese. Eve asks her sister, well, when Moses parts the water and then it drowns, it covers up all the soldiers and drowns all the soldiers, why did God drown the horses too? So for Eve, both religions have a downside, which is the same, in that they both drown horses. They both make the innocent suffer. So those are some of the conflicts that come up, similar to many people's experience of childhood religion, I suppose.
And so in the end, does the film come down the middle, rejecting both belief systems because they both drown horses or because they both have problems?
It doesn't strongly reject either. In the film, the older sister is baptized. That's a scene in the film, and the parents are sitting proudly in the aisles watching this ritual occur. But as a viewer, as you see how these two belief systems are presented in the film, the Chinese beliefs certainly seem much more benign. There isn't really that much there. There isn't that much dogma that can create harm. The only thing that really hurts the children, or can be seen, I suppose, from our viewpoint as hurting the children, is this ultimate parental authority and the respect, the subservience that children have to their parents. But apart from that, their religious beliefs and their ideas about luck are very loose. There's really nothing that you have to do except these few rituals. Whereas the Catholic, a lot is offered. Salvation is offered, and heaven, so on, is offered, and it falls up short, and you right away hit upon that old hypocrisy that bothers so many people and causes people to leave the Christian Church. And there's a shot which really kind of summed it up, the difference between the kind of permissive worldview and the severe Christian worldview is on the altar. There's this fat, laughing Buddha figurine, and right next to it, the emaciated, suffering Christ. And it passes over that. You sort of get the feeling that one of them is a lot easier to take than the other. So that I think is the theological underpinning of the movie in the end.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Laura.
Ah, you're welcome.
I've been talking to Laura Lamb about the film Eve and the Fire Horse. The film is currently playing at both Fifth Avenue Cinemas and at Tinseltown.